Hey, this is Aaron Carnes. We started this podcast in 2021 to promote my book, In Defense of Ska. Since then, the podcast has grown into its own thing. I've been working on an expanded second edition. I interviewed new people, edited every chapter, and there's a new final chapter, 30,000 new words. The expanded second edition of In Defense of Ska will be released on October 29th, 2024. Can you do something for me? Pre-order it right now at clashbooks.com under the Books tab. The more copies it sells in advance, the more it'll get people to support ska music. Thanks.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Our guest today is Jeremy Pena, guitarist and lead singer for the band The Bandaloos. The Bandaloos formed in Austin, Texas in 2008 and relocated to Portland in 2015. From the beginning, they played a mixture of traditional Jamaican-style ska, rocksteady, and reggae, and blended it with soul music. With each album, they've gotten better in their songwriting and production, honoring the roots and heritage of these genres, while also giving them a contemporary flavor. Their latest album, Tell It Like It is a beautifully crafted album that has an absolutely chill, feel-good vibe, while also expressing a lot of heartache, the way any good soul record does. We talk about how Bandaloos, as a traditional band, balances these sometimes opposite impulses to honor the past and look into the future. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis of the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
So when we did the tour with Mustard Plug, the In Defense of Ska tour.
Yes.
The Portland date, the Bandaloos opened, and I felt like their set was way too short. It was so good. I would have listened to them for 2.5 hours.
Next time they open for you, have them do a 2.5 hour set.
How do you feel about a 2.5 hour opening band set?
Well, when that band's the Bandaloos, I'm okay with it.
Yeah. So this is also kind of my vibe for what I like to listen to when I'm at home. I like this type of music. I might be a ska punk guy, but I definitely lean more towards traditional stuff, rock steady stuff, when I'm just playing records at home.
How many times have you listened to the new record, Tell It Like It Is?
I lost count because I actually was listening to it on Spotify and it just kept looping.
Uh-huh.
So, a lot.
I've liked them for a while and I like their records, but I definitely like this record the most. And I really like the production of it. It's lush, but it's got that sort of like analog warm feeling too. But doesn't have any of that retro, like slightly bad recording elements to it. It's all recorded very well.
Yeah, you don't feel like you can just like hear like tape sound being added to it.
No.
I really feel like a band like the Bandaloos helps connect our scene to the roots of the music, which really is an important part of ska.
So I want to start by asking you, Esteban gave me a few questions he wanted me to ask you.
Oh, nice. That'll be fun to hear.
I'm going to toss you an Esteban question to begin this conversation.
Okay.
He said to ask you about the Alaska tour, which I believe was in 2018.
Wow. Yeah, man. Talk about playing to people who need music, you know? Like, yeah. Man, that was a crazy time because, you know, obviously going up there to play, you know, you don't know what to expect when you get to Alaska. At least I didn't. I knew I would see a moose. I was hoping to see a moose.
Did you see a moose?
We did.
Okay.
How big was it? Was it as big as they say?
It was a little guy, but it was still, I mean, it was huge still. No, it didn't have horns though yet. No horns.
Where did you see the moose at?
It was just on the side of the road between.
Just on the side of the road. Okay.
Yeah. Between one of the long drives and we were in a carpool at one point as well, because we were there for like a week and a half. And our host, Hawkins, was like, oh, did you guys see the brown bear? Or like, we're like, what? Wait. He's just got that eagle eye. He's from up there, so he knows. exactly what he's looking at.
I'm really into hiking. Mm-hmm. And I live in California, so I've always assumed that at some point I'm going to see some mountain lions because they're all over California mountains.
Right.
And I've never seen a mountain lion while hiking. The only time I've ever seen a mountain lion was while driving to the hike. One like ran across the road.
Oh, whoa.
But the thing is, like, I've probably been around a ton of mountain lions.
Right. Yeah.
And they've been watching me. Exactly. But I just don't see them.
We have a mountain lion that lives like in this neighborhood that's close to mine, and it shows up on this person's Ring camera like once a month, and they're always posting about it on, you know,
oh,
like,
wow,
the Nextdoor app and stuff.
have they named it yet?
I don't know. You know, they haven't. At least I haven't caught the name if they have.
Okay. If they don't name it, we'll name it.
Right.
The three of us.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. So let's see. So one of the things that I saw regarding your tour was there was a photo of Esteban at an alpaca farm. Was it a farm or just an alpaca?
Oh, yeah. So that was our host who let us borrow the PA, because in Alaska, you have to tour with a PA. You just never know what you're going to, what kind of, you know, what kind of place you're going to end up at and what kind of equipment they're going to have. So luckily, our buddy Hawkins is, like I said, he's from up there. And the main thing was this place called the Girdwood Forest Fair. And we're, you know, playing all week to get to that. But anyway, so the person we borrowed the PA from has like an amazing farm there in Hope, Alaska. And it's just, I saw black roses for the first time there. That was kind of cool. But yeah, it had alpaca, like, I mean, just the whole farm vibe, you know, like anything you can think of. I didn't see any cows, but it was really cool.
So how did this tour happen? Was it because of the person you mentioned?
Yeah. So Hawkins, so the guys that I moved up to Portland to play music with, Curtis and Morgan, they had gone up there several times. I think that was their fifth tour up there. And Hawkins would go, you know, he goes back to see his family and just play music around the trip. And, so he basically, he was like, hey man, would you guys be interested in backing me up on a tour if you guys, you know, want to go up there? Cause we've been I've been like pressuring them like, yo, I want to go to Alaska. I want to play up there. The Slackers haven't played Alaska. I want to play Alaska.
Yeah. You know? You hear that, Slackers?
Yeah. 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 You hear that, Dave? Get on that, Dave.
Throwing down the
I got to connect for you if you need it, Dave. But anyway, yeah, so we were excited just to go up there, and it was all based around that was 2018, so that's our 10-year anniversary. It was July 4th, 2008, when we played our very first show. So it just seemed like a fun thing to do for our 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, did you actually need the PA for any of the shows?
We did. Let's see, it's so long ago and it's like COVID in between. I'm trying.
Sure.
It's kind of hard to remember, but, the place in Seward had one, and you know what? I don't think we actually did need the PA after all, because the Girdwood Forest Fair was like a legit festival. And right before our set, the, stage manager came over and was like, hey, just so you're aware, we just, you know, tranquilized a bear about 30 feet behind the stage. And we were like, oh, okay, well, maybe we should say something to the crowd. They were like, no, do not say anything to the crowd. That would freak them all out. And so we were just like, all right, well, hopefully this guy, you know, falls asleep before our set and I have to worry about, you know, running with my guitar and stuff.
So you had to carry that burden yourself.
Yeah, a little bit. And we were all nervous about it, but yeah, it was a trip, man.
So there was also, I think in that same post about the alpaca, there was a mention of an Anchorage distillery that sponsored the group's biggest hangover.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I know exactly what Esteban wants me to talk about now. So you know what? And this was the one show that we probably did use that PA for. We played in this place called Whittier, Alaska. And the only way to get through there, it was like a military base, and they basically just, you know, a way through the mountain to get there. And there's only one way in and one way out. And the way it closes, it's basically you're driving on train tracks, and it's like a 4 mile tunnel. And anyway, we play the show and it's show up and it's like a, it looks like The Shining or something, like the hotel. And basically they're like, well, we can't really have drums. So the drummer had the night off. So we ended up playing basically a full band without drums, which is kind of weird, but also fun. And I was a little jealous that Morgan had the night off, but yeah. So anyway, we play this show. Before the show, we go to, you know, the Anchorage distillery and they give us a case of vodka. I still have one bottle of it. I think we only came home with two or three of them. We kind of gave them out to people who were, you know, hanging with us. And we're like, oh, you know, they cooked for us or whatever. So we'd give them a bottle of vodka or gin. And, and we were on a big Bloody Mary kick, honestly, like, at the distillery, they made this Bloody Mary mix and it was just so good. And, anyway, we play that show in Whittier. It's kind of a, you know, there's only like 6-7 people in there watching us, all fishers, you know, coming off basically to just enjoy the evening. And we get back to our hotel room, which ends up being, we're like, they're like, hey, is one hotel room enough? And we're thinking to ourselves, like, man, no, not really. But can we ask for two? So Hawkins asked for another one and blah, blah, blah. So we get there and these aren't hotel rooms. These are apartments. There's like a 3-bedroom apartment, both of them. So we got 2 3-bedroom apartments for 6 people. And the show ended so early, we kind of got lit and it was a Thursday and the entire town of Whittier, Alaska, people, if you guys don't know about Whittier, Alaska, look it up. There's a PBS documentary on it about how the entire town live in these two buildings. So it's like a, I don't know, probably a 13-story building, 2 13-story buildings. And, you know, everything's in there. You got the post office, you got the grocery store, you got the, you know, everything is just consists in these two buildings and these crazy people from the lower 48 come up there and and just honestly, I mean, we had the biggest night there because what we did was we got big V8, poured probably an entire bottle of vodka in one of those V8s, put the bloody mix in there. And I had the idea after I shook it up and mixed it real well, I grabbed the cap and I just tossed it as far as I could. And I was like, we're drinking this entire thing tonight. And so we just started passing the bottle around. And before we knew it, it's like 1:30 in the morning on a Thursday. And we're singing Beatles songs outside of all these people's windows at the bottom. And it's kind of like a courtyard. So our voices are just echoing up the the walls. And after, you know, 20 minutes of singing some, you know, Obladi, Oblada, or whatever we were doing, we started getting yelled at by the locals. And they're like, shut up. What do y'all do? Who are y'all kind of thing? And so we had to take the party inside. Oh, man. And yeah, and at one point, Esteban kind of disappeared. And I was like, well, I'll go up to the room to and this isn't going to be as funny to y'all. But like I was like, I'll go find him and we'll come back out and hang out and be quiet over here in this other area or whatever. And I go to open up the elevator and I'm pretty faded. And I was telling the guys, I was like, you know, Esteban's probably in this elevator and we, you know, he's coming down. I just had that sense. And for sure the door's open. Nobody's there. But all of a sudden Esteban just does this little, like he was hiding on the side you couldn't see, and did this little twirl and spin and like entrance into the room. And I just lost it, dude. I don't think I've been as happy as I was in that moment. I just fell to the ground and Esteban was like, holy shit, I've never seen you like this. And I probably haven't been like that since then, but yeah, just, I'm a happy drunk. So it was all good.
Esteban, if you're listening, next time I see you, I want to see this little move.
Yeah, it was impressive. I mean, it was awesome. And then the next morning we woke up with a boot on our van.
Why did the van get booted?
Man, so we didn't know that we were, you know, in whatever room we were in. And I guess you wouldn't think that Alaska, you would have like an assigned parking lot to go to, sure. Especially because it's an entire gravel, basically parking lot. And so we even parked kind of toward the end of it and walked all the way in. And so we got up in the morning and we had a boot on our van. But luckily, the entire town is in that building. So it kind of feels like a high school when you're down below, like you're going to the principal's office to talk to whoever to try to get the boot off. And, I was like, well, we got to get to our next gig, blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, they were like, yeah, y'all were supposed to park over here. Y'all were loud last night and all that. And I was like, well, what is it going to take to get this boot off? And I know it was going to be like the, on the ticket itself, it said like $75 or $100 or something. But I guess I just handed them a 20 and I guess they just pocketed it because we didn't have to come out of pocket as much as the ticket said.
Nice. Do you think they booted it more because of where you parked or because of the loud singing?
I think both because you got to see this van we were in. We were in a Sprinter van.
Okay.
We rented it from some friends of Hawkins and Curtis. Blackwater Railroad is the name of their band. They're like a bluegrass and folk band, Americana stuff. And anyway, on this van, like I think they're the biggest band in Alaska. They have it looks like a Formula One, not a Formula One, NASCAR, because it's got all these sponsors across it. So it's got like, you know, I can't remember any of the sponsors off the top of my head, but like say Dos Equis or like, you know, a big weed sponsor over here or big, whatever it might be like. So, so it looks like a driving billboard anyway. Yeah. So it could be a combination of all three things of where we parked, what the van looked like and how loud we were.
I've always been surprised more bands that's not like a thing.
I know, because I feel like it's a wasted opportunity for gas money.
Yeah, for sure.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just released a brand new record for Bandaloos, Tell It Like It Is.
Yes, sir.
Well, I want to get into this album. I think the album is really good.
Thank you.
And so I want to talk a little bit about the songwriting and the production, because the production also feels like a step up for you guys as well.
Yeah. I mean, we were lucky enough to record the majority of it in Belgium. We recorded four of the 12 songs here in town with Esteban and Curtis Engineering. And what happened was we were just doing these four songs to kind of do some singles and it was going to kind of lead up to the London International Ska Fest. Like, we didn't really have anyone to put them out yet. I might have self-released, or we were shooting ideas basically. Mm-hmm. And about 3 weeks before the London show, you know, we all had tickets in hand, basically all of us except for our drummer and singer, Emma, at the time. We all had tickets, non-refundable hotels and all that good stuff. And Sean Flowerdew calls me and is like, mate, it's not happening. I was like, what do you mean? It's like, yeah, we're supposed to be there. And he's like, yeah, it's just the COVID, you know, was still going strong at that time. And we were just, I mean, that was July of 2022. We were just there in April of 2022 to play the Cologne, Freedom Sounds in Cologne. And so we were like, well, I mean, things are kind of coming back at this point, but I don't blame me for, you know, throwing it off or, you know, basically canceling the festival. And I was like, well, let's just make lemonade out of these lemons that were handed to us. And at Freedom Sounds, I ran into, you know, we play with Victor Rice and Nico from Batasonic Records is the drummer for Victor Rice. And we kind of hit it off that time. So I just hit him up. I was like, hey, man, we're going to have all this time. We're coming to Europe just for fun now because our show got canceled. And do you think we could possibly, you know, record one or two songs? And so I was thinking maybe four at the most. And I had some ideas kicking around. So I sent them five tunes. And he was like, yeah, I got 2 days. And with that first day, we recorded all five ideas that I already sent them. And we're happy with them. So the next day we're like, well, what are we going to do? And I just like kind of had to figure out old songs that I hadn't finished. And it kind of made me finish them on this, you know, there, at least give them a form. I was able to come back and finish out lyrics here and before I recorded my vocals. But so it's kind of an accident.
So Jeremy, the majority of the record mm-hmm. was recorded in 2 days.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So all the basses for not the pianos and stuff. So like guitars, bass and drums, mm-hmm. Both guitars, cause Mario plays lead. Yeah. We all did it live and we kind of just played through it twice before we cut the, what you're hearing for the basses. Wow. And then, Esteban did all his keyboards over here and we had Mikey Shasha fill in on a real piano. Let's see. Yeah. What else is there?
What about vocals?
Vocals. We did it all here in Portland. I did a lot of some of those vocals I did there, like on the four songs or five songs that I already had done. And, but a lot of it, you know, we just kind of, cause Curtis has a little overdub room here at his house. And, I just kind of fixed whatever I didn't like.
Yeah.
And and then we did all the ladies because the ladies didn't come with us over there. Morgan and Emma waited until the last second to buy their ticket, but before they bought their ticket, they had canceled the festival. So I told them, "Yo, don't buy them because we're not gonna be able to get paid back for this. Like we're kind of coming out of pocket and losing our ass because of the the London thing." But so they didn't come, and that's why Nico's playing drums on the majority of the record, and which is a dream come true because I've looked up to Nico since like I want to say it was the Moon Invader. You know, he's in a band called the Moon Invaders. It was probably the Movin' and Groovin' record that came out like in 06, maybe something like that. Around the same time, I had kind of transitioned out of ska punk into the more traditional side of things.
Is that the record that you would really point to just sort of show what it is you love about his drumming?
You know, it was all of it because not only just his drumming, but he is the producer as well. So he's like the engineer. He's like, and he's mixing it all. It's all of that stuff. And their song, he writes a lot of the songs too. And so, and then I just always seen his name and plus the Hardison brothers' names on those records. And I was like, one of these days I just want to see them, you know, and now here he is. Here he is. He's, you know, he's my drummer now, basically over there. So it's a crazy, crazy thing that, you know, someone that I've looked up to for so long is, you know, it's like, feels like I'm legitimate all of a sudden. It's like, I've arrived, you know?
Now, I'm, you know, listening to, this is your fourth record as Bandaloos. Listening to each record, I feel like you kind of see a progression from the production standpoint.
Definitely.
And I think like when it comes to bands like you that are clearly rooted in the traditions of the music, there is this balancing act of how do you connect yourself to the past without being stuck in the past, right?
Right.
And so that's kind of what I'm curious about in terms of the production and the instrumentation and the writing of this record, because it feels like you guys really pulled it off, or it doesn't feel like a retro record, but it does feel like it really connects to the past in a pretty cohesive way.
Oh, nice. Yeah. You know, what's one different thing about this record than from the other ones, besides the production and all that, is there's no solos in any of the songs. If you notice. So it's very pop oriented. Big man upon the scene, drove a mean machine, but seemed a bit shady. It's very like to the point versus some of our past records have been jams, like especially that first record, like almost every song I'm like, all right, verse, chorus, solo, chorus, out, you know, and a lot of my writing style goes that way. And then I always lean hard on the organ or the keyboard, or excuse me, the guitar.
Also the nature of your songs, how they're a lot of them are like heartbreak songs. I feel like that connects to the past pretty well, to like the origins of this music and soul music as well. Actually, I want to give you a quote that you had said in a different article as sort of a jumping off point.
Yeah.
All right. I always wanted the Dulus to make traditional ska, reggae, and soul records. We don't want to reinvent the wheel or experiment. Having backup singers help me lean into my soul side a little harder, but I try not to write a song in any specific genre. We like everything to happen as organic as possible. I just like playing roots music. And I think that's the part I'm kind of curious in, is like this concept that you're playing roots music and what that means as a modern songwriter.
Facts, man. It's just like, I want to rewrite, you know, Isn't She Lovely, you know, but in my voice, and which is way more positive than my lyrics tend to be. But it's like, oh man, he's so happy, you know, but, yeah, I guess, you know, I originally started in ska punk music, and because of Greg Lee, rest in peace, he kind of got me into the room of traditional ska. And so I grew up, my family is, I'm like fourth or fifth generation musician. My dad played in Tejano bands and cumbia bands and country bands and blues bands. So he kind of, you know, spanned the entire,
yeah, you know,
all the genres basically. And so when I, growing up, he was mostly a Tejano musician, and he'd play with these guys named Alfonso Ramos and Little Joe, like legends in the Tejano world.
And for context, for people that don't know, you're from Texas. You
live in
Portland now, but you're from Texas.
Yes. Yes. Born and raised Austin, Texas. Yeah. I moved up here what, 8-9 years ago this year.
I just think the Tejano, I think that was an important distinction because that's very much part of the culture of Texas.
Right. Yeah, man. And when I heard Hepcat, I was like, yo, this is a lot like what my dad does, but you know, it's just a cousin, you know, they're just across the Gulf, you know, basically to, you know, like all that, all the music down there is just like, they're all a big family. And, so yeah, I was just like, oh, this is the cousin I want to go out on a date with, you know, but, yeah, so once I heard that, and I knew at the same time that my dad would actually probably like that a lot too. Like, and his validation was always big importance to me.
What instrument did your dad play?
Everything. But majority, he started on the saxophone in high school, then guitar. But the majority of my life, he played keyboards, organ, the accordion. So anything with keys, basically. And he was the band leader and song arranger and all that stuff. And then my mom was the singer of the band the majority of the time too. They had a band called, my favorite is Jalapeña and the Chili Peppers because of our last name. And, and that had always been a hilarious joke. And then his blues band, it wasn't his name, but this guy that he used to play with, they were called the Moldy Figs. And I always thought that was hilarious. Moldy Figs.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's some Texas shit right there.
Yeah. So then what's your first memory? Like him, did he start trying to show you stuff like musically at a young age?
No. So, all right. So check it out. My, his parents, my grandma and grandpa, Lucinda and Joe, they had a Mexican restaurant in the town that I grew up in. So I grew up right outside of Austin in a little town called Elgin, Texas. Looks like Elgin, but it's pronounced Elgin. famous for bricks and sausage. Mm. Yes. I mean, great barbecue. But I don't eat beef anymore, so I don't partake anymore, but I do miss the smell.
But you do know that it's good.
Yes. Yes. But anyway, so they had a little bar in downtown. It was bar on one side and with live music, and then on the other side was a Mexican restaurant, and then connecting the two was a little like pool table and some arcade games and one of the claw machine to get you a stuffed animal. But anyway, so yeah, he ran the bar side, basically booking bands. My dad did. And he basically, he could book bands, but his band played all the time, Thursday through, I would say, Sunday. And so as early as 4 years old, I'll be on the stage with my blanket, you know, as they're playing to a crowd of people dancing. And I'm just like sleeping on the corner of the stage. Or sometimes they would even, because I started out as a drummer and I started playing that early, like at 4 years old. And of course I wasn't good at all, but they would amuse the crowd by letting the little 4 year old play the drums sometimes on a half a song. And so those are like my really early memories. But it wasn't until, and my very first concert was with them going to see Al Green, which was amazing. I do remember him tossing out roses like paper planes to the ladies. And
that's amazing.
That was cool, man. Yeah, that was real cool. The Aquafest back in the early 90s of Austin. But it wasn't until I was like 12 years old. My best friend growing up, Jared Canada, his dad, Eddie Canada, was an artist for if you guys ever heard of Antone's Blues Club from Austin, it's world famous in the blues scene. Like Buddy Guy would play there, Albert King, you know, started in the early, maybe mid 70s. Stevie Ray Vaughan did a lot of work there, and Jimmy Vaughan and the Fabulous Thunderbirds, those guys. Anyway, in the 90s, my friend's dad dated the sister of the club owner. So Clifford owned the club and Susan was his sister. So Eddie and Susan were together for years. And so on weekends or in the summertime, I would always be in Austin with them at their place downtown. It was so rad. And I got exposed to a lot of blues music that way. But one Sunday, they had this little, they were like, oh yeah, we're doing a teenage guitar virtuosos kind of show, early matinee. And it was this guy named Jake Andrews, who was an Austin native, and Derek Trucks of Tedeschi and Trucks. You know, he ended up marrying Susan Tedeschi. So anyway, they were like 15 or 16. I was like 12. And they played the Santo and Johnny song, Sleepwalk. And I just loved that song so much. And I knew that I was like, if these guys could do it, I mean, I could do it. My dad could teach me this. So literally that Sunday after that weekend, I went home and I was like, Dad, I want you to play this or teach me how to. And I didn't know the name of the song. I was just like, you know, trying to, bam, bam, can you play me? Can you teach me how to play this? And he knew exactly what I was talking about. And so, within a week, I was annoying my siblings. Because I was just like hooked. I was just hooked.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into playing.
What was your entry point into ska and punk then?
Oh, okay. So, man, I started, you know, I would say that Kurt Cobain taught me how to play guitar and stuff, playing bar chords and blah, blah, blah. But it was NoFX, NoFX, Goldfinger, all that stuff. My friends actually kind of, they were kind of more of the people who, you know, showed me that music, because my friend Alan especially showed me who the Mad Caddies were. And I was like, man, these guys are crazy. Like this Dixieland and like, what is all this, you know? And anyway, so, but NoFX was my jam, and Lagwagon, honestly, still my jam. I still go see them every time they're in town. It would be like a certain NoFX song and I'll be like, wait a minute, what's this slower part of the ska and reggae that they're doing, or the ska part that they're doing? Like, that's what I'm drawn to. And then my friend Duncan's older brother had this maroon van, caravan, Dodge Caravan, and he came to pick him up from somewhere sometime, and he was blasting Hepcat. I stopped what I was doing. I was like, who is this? And then it took me a while to find a Hepcat CD anywhere, because, you know, back then it wasn't so available.
Yeah.
And really had to like figure it out. And luckily went down to the local store called Cheapo's, rest in peace, found Scientific. And that was my Bible right there. And then because of that, I found out about Give 'Em, you know, I knew about the Give 'Em the Boot records, and my friend TJ had played me, you know, the Give 'Em the Boot with the Watch This, the Slackers one. That one always stuck out to me, but it was Hepcat that really like grabbed me. And, I was just like, oh, my dad's going to love this, you know, but yeah. And then later on, I just got way into the Slackers because, I went to finally see them. I went to their, it was, the Wasted Days tour. I have the poster, not in this room, but, November 2nd, my sister's birthday of 2001, they played with Los Carnales. And the next night, they always do two nights in Austin. We were spoiled like that. The second night, they played with the Stingers. I missed the first night, so I didn't see Scarnales, but I went to see the Stingers. And then I was like, there's someone local? Someone local does this too? So, yeah, and that was, you know, that was back in the QMAX days and of the Slackers. And that's, I mean, that then I got bit by the bug because I saw it live. And then the Stingers were an Austin staple. So I ended up just always going to every Stingers show, whether, you know, I could get in or not. Cause a lot of times I was underage, but in Texas, luckily, if you just admit you were a minor, they get that big Magnum 44, put big X's on your hands and they just let you run wild. Unlike, you know, up here where they separate the crowds. Yeah. So I was lucky in that sense of being able to just be immersed in it all.
When did you get connected to the origins of the music and really interested in that?
It had to be around that time because I would say, I can tell you actually, it's 2005. I had just, my daughters, my oldest daughter was just born. Well, she's probably three at that point, but the Stingers, again, they were playing at, and I didn't, and I knew about the Scottalites. It was more of a name than a sound to me at that point. And anyway, they played at this place called Jupiter Records, and I found my very first Scottalite CD there, and it was Nucleus of Ska, and it's just kind of like a compilation. And I was like, man, this kind of sounds rickety a little bit, you know? You're like, you're listening to the productions, like, so, you know, it's what they, you know, could do at the time. But, and it took a while for me to like really get, it was more of the Rocksteady era that kind of pulled me into that, like Alton Ellis and Ken Booth. I was like, oh man. And then I went back and really like dove into the Scottalites. But, yeah, probably around 2004, 2005, I traded my distortion pedal because I ended up quitting my, I was in a ska punk band. We were wanting to be Rancid or the Suicide Machines. We were called Captain Bring Down and the Buzz Killers, Simpsons reference. I traded my distortion pedal for a delay. Yeah.
And then you were also later in Los Carnales for a little while.
Yeah. So throwing that out there. In Captain Bring Down, we would open up for Scarnales. And of course I was just, they were like, all over the place. They played cumbia, they played punk, they played you know, reggae, they played ska, they played it all. And that was exciting. I mean, that's kind of why if you listen to a Bandulu's records, you're going to get a ska, a reggae, a soul, a rocksteady. Like, we're going to jump genres because it's all about the mood of whatever's going on. And but yeah, Scarnales, I became good friends with them, opening it up for them. And Ryan Scroggins in particular, the keyboard player of the time, and Beans, the drummer, he was like, man, I'm going to do this little side project. I would love for you to come to town to play on it. And at that same time I was doing that, all of a sudden Kenny was about to have a baby. So Kenny was a guitar player, and they were like, well, let's just have Jeremy do it. He was, you know, he played punk in this band and blah, blah, blah. So he kind of just like, there was no tryout or anything. He was just like, no, this is happening. You're our guitar player now. And Felipe was totally down. Felipe was like, yeah, of course. Yeah, man, that makes sense. And it was a very short lived time because Scarnales ended up breaking up. That was at the beginning of 2006. And by November of 2006, we had played our last show. And that was with Ozo Motley. and I had quit my job. I was working at UPS. I was making decent money part-time at UPS. And I quit my job to move to Houston because literally every Tuesday for about 5 years, I would drive from Austin to Houston just for rehearsal. And talk about dedication to ska music, you know?
how long's that drive?
It's 163 miles each way, about 2.5 hours. About, you can get there hour 45 and no traffic if you leave at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, in those days, not anymore. But yeah, so every Tuesday night I was driving down there, rehearsing, waking up Wednesday morning, driving back for 5 years. That's
dedication.
And so when Skarnalas broke up, then Ryan's band, Ryan Scroggins and the Trenchtown Texans, we've put out 3 records with those guys. We from 2007 and 2008 and some of 2009, we were pretty active and did a bunch of tours. We did Skarnalas was supposed to go on a tour to LA with Hub City Stompers, and we were going to play the very first 3 floors of ska, with like the Toasters, the Phenomenauts, cool band from back then who is now called the Amalgamated, the Highlights back then. And I saw the Pedal Tones and, you know, and I was just in awe of that scene. And so like, I just knew like, these are my people.
What the event was called? 3 Floors of Sky?
Yeah. So Bucket from the Toasters used to have this event called the 3 Floors of Sky. He did it in New York for a number of years at the Knitting Factory up in New York. And so we played the very first one in L.A., and we did a whole tour, like I said, with Hub City in a van without reverse, mind you. Yeah, we played it at the
without reverse,
no reverse, and the drive shaft. Apparently, I don't know anything about cars, but my brother was saying, "Yo, this drive shaft underneath your van is held together by duct tape." I was like, "Are you serious?" We rented the van from from one of our bass players' cousins. And he's like, yeah, there's no reverse, but it'll get you there and back. And it was pretty, you know, it wasn't in the best shape, but man, I think it was a workhorse and got us to and from all the way out to San Francisco and back to Houston in 11 days or whatever it was. And yeah, we only had to wait one time for someone to leave so we can pull forward. And that was in San Francisco we played the Red Devil Lounge with La Plebe back then. Mm.
I remember the band. I do not remember the venue.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think it was almost. I think it was in Tenderloin, maybe.
Okay.
Somewhere. Maybe it was kind of close to Cow Hollow. God, I don't know. Something like that.
We'll be right back after this.
I want to go back to Tell It Like It Is, and I want to kind of go back to this idea about roots music and how you're playing traditional music and not inventing. So when you think about that, specifically when you're thinking about Tell It Like It Is and maybe even some songs on that, what is it you have in mind and what is it you're hearkening to when you're writing and performing this music?
You know, I have to give this credit to the bass player from Skarnalas. Yeah, I always go off on side notes, my bad. Nick Gaitan was the one. It was like, you know, it just resonated with me, and I'm kind of just stealing his thing. But yeah, he was just like, I just want to play, rewrite old standards in my voice, like I said earlier. But really, man, I guess it comes down to being a little bit of a traditionalist. I don't know, even though I'm not really, but just that musically I am. And I don't really know.
Yeah. I mean, are you thinking about the Jamaican stuff? Are you thinking about bands that have carried the traditional stuff forward? I mean, I'm just curious when you think about it, what is it you're personally hearkening to?
I'm really wanting to be Alton Ellis, man. If I that is like, that's who I want to be. I want to be Alton Ellis. I want to be Ken Booth. My dream is to play one of those Halloween shows where everybody covers someone else and we just do
Alton Ellis.
Yeah. And Alton Ellis tunes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's who like, I'm really, you know, wanting to grasp and be that.
If there's a song on the new record where you felt like you got the closest that you've ever gotten, what would that song be?
Man, I think Shadows is a really killer rock steady vibe.
And I know that you think of me now.
I remember just in the playback, right as soon as we cut it, because this was the first one we also cut directly to tape. Mm-hmm. Everything else has been digital. And I just, it was just so warm. The tones just was like perfect. And of course, Nico just plays the rock steady, right? And with Curtis and Mario, like we just worked really well together. And we all have that same goal of just trying to make the most authentic, but new, you know, contemporary.
Sure. Yeah. Something about the record I've noticed. And so you kind of talked about one thing already, and that's recording to tape, getting the warmth of tape, but just listening closely, it's like, okay, I hear the drums, I hear the upstrokes on the guitar, but I think I hear a second guitar hitting notes. There's keyboards. I think I'm maybe hearing some percussion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this how the songs are written, or is this you guys utilizing the studio to really craft the best sounding songs you can have?
Yeah, well, Mario always does his little. I call Mario the color. We're the outline, and he's just doing his little guitar, his best Len Tate that he can. And it is all about utilizing the studio. And Curtis is a producer in himself. He produced the whole Love a Woman album that we put out, and he's definitely got that mind of like, oh, this needs, you know, first, you know, a difference between a cabasa or a tambourine. He's the one that's going to be like, no, you know what? It should be this, and it should be this rhythm. And so his mind really operates on that producer level when we're in there. So that's where you get all the fun little toys.
Yeah. I really think that when it comes to music, like traditional ska soul music, capturing warmth seems to really make the music come to life. Whereas other styles, you know, maybe not so much. I mean, like Op Ivy's record is so good because it's the opposite of warm.
Right.
As an example, but like really getting that warmth of all the instruments and the blend of it really feels like that's what this music needs.
Yeah, it really is. And recording together, like playing live in the room and actually capturing the feel of what is going to be later performed on stage.
Yeah. There's really something to be said for that. Like in any genre of music, I think.
Yeah, totally.
As much of it as you can capture live all together playing at the same time, there's something ephemeral about that, that you can't replicate when you track everything individually.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. It just seems, I don't know, I guess it just gives it a little more raw feel, I guess. And yeah, you know, that's, love that.
And you said it earlier, your first impression of the Scottalites was that it was rickety.
Yeah. I'm borrowing that term as well from Greg Narvas. Yeah. but yeah, exactly. He said that. I was like, that's exactly what I thought, but I just couldn't articulate it at that time, you know? And yeah.
You listen to Scottalites and you listen to what you guys are doing this record. It's fascinating to hear how music can sound rickety, but also tight. Like there's a certain level of tightness where it would no longer be rickety. Like it is, and there's a certain level of rickety where it would not sound tight. It would just sound sloppy.
Yeah.
So what is that little bridge, that little area of,
it's gotta be the tune and the musicianship, man. It's just like that just goes right by the capabilities of sound engineering at that time. You know, it's just like, it's, man, Don Drummond.
One way you guys kind of achieve that on the new record is the use of additional percussion on some of the stuff.
Yeah.
Like some of that really adds that feel.
Mm-hmm. We used to have when the band was based in Texas, we had a percussionist who'd had all, every tool you could think of, every little fun toy. He had a little bag that made all kinds of noises and we called it the funny bag. The funny bag. We're like, Nico, did you bring the funny bag? Yeah, bro. I got the funny bag back there, bro. but yeah, man, I mean, yeah, that's more color, you know. It just adds that extra twinkle or whatever it is, and of course wherever Nico puts it in the faders, it could hit your ear here or it could hit you here down here, you know. It's like, I don't know, it's just something special about that.
Yeah.
Your point, because this is all audio, you're pointing to your head and you're pointing to your stomach, right?
Yeah, either up on the top part of your right ear or the bottom part of your left ear. Like it just, you know, yeah, it just hits different way, you know?
Sure.
You moved to Portland in 2015, I believe.
Yeah.
So just before you moved to Portland, you recorded a record at Daptone Record Studios in New York, right? Yeah,
I did. Big up Channel Tubes, Brett Tubin for making that happen, and Tommy Brennick from Budos Band and Sharon Jones.
It is a unreleased record as of this point, right?
It's an unreleased record. It's just now. Like, honestly, we just finished it.
Just finished.
10 years in the yeah, 10 years in 10 the years. Making.
How long are we gonna have to wait to get to hear it though?
That's a good question. I had to put it. I mean, I really, honestly, you know, so that's our first time recording the tape, because we recorded there on their A-track and got to use Sharon Jones's mic. Oh my gosh, got to
wow. You know,
I mean, I've been lucky enough to see her. Sharon Jones is one of my biggest heroes, and I've been lucky to see her at least 20 times, if not more. Wow. I worked in radio for a long time, so I got to go to South by Southwest stuff and get the badges and all the cool. I call them dick moves, like the dick move pass. Like, oh yeah, I get to cut the line. Sorry, dude, I got a badge. Yeah, but yeah, man, just. That was an experience on its own. I got hooked up with that because of, like I said, Channel Tubes, Brett Tubin out of New York. We were originally going to record at Daptone's sister studio, the Diamond Mind, which is now they still got the Diamond Mind in I think it's in Long Island City, somewhere around there. But now they got Diamond Mind West, and now it's a whole record label that the Budos, Tommy from the Budos Band, and and he, you know, he did Charles Bradley stuff. But yeah, this band from London called Texas, ironically, booked out the entire month. And so it kind of bumped us off of our 3 days that we had, because they were giving us a homie hookup. Like, I only paid $1,500 to record for 3 days with their engineer, Wayne Gordon. And because of that band, like, for me, it was better, because I mean, I would be stoked to record a Diamond Mind, no doubt, but to be able to step foot and be able to spend, you know, 3 days at Daptone, it ended up being a fourth day, because we had to go back and just get all of our bounce downs, and during that day was even more fun, because Budos Band was actually mixing their record at the time, so I got to hang out with those guys, and just thinking about it now, that was a really awesome experience.
What was your connection to the Daptone bands, the Brooklyn Rocksteady bands, and Frighteners, which were both of those things?
So I'm a go-getter, man. I'm a go-getter. I try to meet everybody I can. I've become really good friends with the Slackers over the years. And let's see, how did that all happen? All right. Sammy K. I'll tell you how that happened.
Sammy K.
Sammy K. always comes back. I met Sammy K. He's probably 15 years old at the time. The Trenchtown Texans, we went up to the Northeast. Hub City Stompers, it even goes back further. Hub City Stompers is how I have all that connection, because there's a Texas-New Jersey connection. We call it La Ska Familia. And yeah, Nuno and, you know, the Nuno years when he was on drums, and back in Matty Glock days, like the Dirty Jersey record that came out. We would go up and play. Nuno had this, it's a scooter rally, the scooter rally. And we'd play at Asbury Lanes at Asbury Park. And I just would just go all the time. And so I met Sammy there. Very first time I met him, it was at Django's house, King Django. And we showed up, and King Django's just yelling at Sammy. Sammy, you need to clean the pool, goddammit. Like, there's too many leaves over here. Well, and after that, you need to go mow the lawn and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, so I just kept in touch with Sammy. I've known him for half my life at this point. And at the time, he was dating. I would go up there, and the Forthrights would back me up. Or even the Frighteners backed me up one time, just a few songs. But with the Forthrights, we did a whole Fourth Dulu set. So it was half Forthrights and half Dulu songs.
So Sammy was in the Forthrights at this point.
Yeah,
right?
Sammy was in the Forthrights. And that was a few years after we had met already. But because of that, I met Grace of Spades, the Queen Grace.
She's known as a DJ and stuff, right? Up in that scene, yeah.
Yeah, totally. And she knows everybody. And just over the years, you know, New York kind of came a second home for me. New York and San Diego, I was flying both places. I'd have the band, The Amalgamated, in San Diego back me up during those times. And then when the Fourth Rights got established, I was using those guys. And Agent J put on, because I was looking for a show in New York, and he was like, oh, they made something happen. And what he made happen was ended up being kind of a residency for a little while called the Punky Reggae Party. He would do it at least once or twice a year for a few years. And that's when I was playing with Fourth Rights and the Frighteners. And because of that connection and knowing Grace, every time I went to New York, I would just stay with Grace. And eventually, after her and Sammy broke up, she started dating Brett. And Brett knows everybody as well. He, you know, he played in Westbound Train. He played with, you know, he fills in with everybody, but his main band is the Fool Watts band, Uziman. And we just became really good friends. And so eventually I was like, I want you to produce this next record, you know, and because every record I've worked with someone different. I haven't worked with the same person twice, but it's been interesting that way.
So I'm really curious about what you learned from a production standpoint from working at the Daptone studio and working on that project.
Yeah, man, honestly, I haven't learned anything. I'm just there to, I let the producers do their thing. You know, I'm just there I'm just there for them to get the best out of me kind of thing.
But you must, like, even if you don't know anything technically, you must have aha moments where you go like, that's what this is supposed to sound like, and kind of keep that in your head.
For sure. Yeah. And as long as it sounds like traditional, I guess we're coming back to that, but like, yeah, just as long as it has that quality of it, you know, I know I'm on the right track.
Okay. So Daptone Records, they're primarily a soul label. Although they had the Frighteners on their label, and they are, you know, more of a rock steady kind of group.
Every day I wake, it's getting harder just to take. I try to fake a smile, but nothing hides my sadness.
And they're also very interested in sort of capturing like a retro vibe. So the record that you recorded there, did you guys really lean into the retro sounds, or did you go for something a little different?
It's all the retro sounds, man. Yeah, we got to use just using those amps. Mario all of a sudden sounded like he was Tommy Brennick. Like, I was like, oh, that's not Tommy in the room. That's just Mario. but we're always trying to go for that traditional soul, like the old school sound if we can. But man, that, I don't know. I'm just thinking back that Magnetone amp now that I was playing out of.
I am excited for, I'm going to guess maybe another 10 years when we get to hear the record.
Yeah, right. That's what Esteban always says. Esteban's like, that shit's never coming out, bro. Whatever.
That's a good Esteban impression.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's been many a night with that fool. But yeah, no, I'm forever the optimist, and I have patience, sometimes too much patience, as you can tell, 10 years. But at the same time, you know, when I, right, so we recorded that record in 2014. A year and a half later, I moved to Portland and everything was on the back burner. So I had to rehearse up a new band, all around new members to the two records I had before that, just to get back to playing live. And so a lot of it, you know, obviously was on the back burner. And I would go to and from New York to finish some vocals here and there. But ultimately, me and Brett set a date. We were like, all right, March 17th. It was 2020, not March 17th, 2020. You're going to fly.
Ooh, that's a good date.
Yep.
Picked a great date.
You're going to fly to Portland and we're going to redo all these vocals and we're going to knock it out and we're going to finish this damn record, you know? And sure enough, the world shut down 4 days before he was supposed to come. But ultimately, he did come in March of 2022. And that's when we recorded. All the vocals are done. All the couple of guitar parts that needed to be done. There's still one like solo missing, but I don't even care. It's fine. We'll just groove with the rock steady as a solo. It doesn't need to be there. No one needs to shine. Yeah. But and so yeah, so it's been like, you know, the hardest project I've ever worked on, but I know it's going to be one of the most satisfying once it's done.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Now, so, okay, 2015, you moved to Portland, and one of the reasons, as I understand it, was to, because Curtis Irie was there.
Yeah.
So little side tangent here. Curtis has come up one time on this podcast.
Yeah.
What I believe is the most random reference.
Is it going to be with the Menzingers?
Yes. Tom May from the Menzingers talked about Curtis because I believe he was in Bob and the Saggots, right?
Bob and the Saggots. Yeah. the Menzingers are basically, yeah, that's Bob and the Saggots minus Curtis. No.
I believe that is, yes. It's three members of Menzingers were in Bob and the Saggots and Curtis. And then he did not get to go on to the Menzingers, I guess.
No. I do know the story, but I don't want to tell it because I'll probably get it wrong of why he's not there. But I'm glad he's not because he's with me.
Yeah.
But also, I'm glad he knows those guys because, man, we were just in Philadelphia back in October and we got to go hang out with Tom during one of the Phillies games was going on. And he just got to – I'd been to Philadelphia several times, but it's also like usually just in the airport or in a venue. Or like, you know, just real quick in and out. But we actually I got to spend like 3 days there. And Tom took us out one night and just had a ball, like drinking till 7 a.m. He ended up leaving early. But since we're on West Coast time and on the East Coast, it's like, of course, 7 a.m. is only 3, you know, or yeah. 4 for us over here. So,
yeah.
Who doesn't drink till 4 in the morning, right?
Yeah, right? At least once a week, right?
Yeah, just once a week. That's good for you.
But yeah, man. So yeah. Yeah, Tommy and the Menzingers, they were just here not too long ago.
So Curtis is from that area.
He's from Clark Summit, which is like Scranton. Him and Morgan were both from that area. Well, Morgan's from an even smaller place called Factoryville. Was it northeastern PA or whatever out there by Wilkes-Barre? And so the way I met Curtis again, Sammy Kay, always. Sammy Kay coming through with, I don't know, it had to have been the Fast Four. They were on tour with Gaslight Anthem. And on their way out to meet the Gaslight Anthem, I booked them in Austin. And of course, they always stay with me. And that's where me and Curtis hit it off.
Is that the band with Sammy Kay and Cat, who became Catbite?
Yeah, and Tim Hildebrand. Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. All those guys. Yeah. And one of the back then it was the twins. I can't remember what's the bassist's name. It's escaping
Ben?
Me. But yeah, yeah. So back then both twins were there, and man, yeah, those were good times. That band was fun. The Fast Four, they were good.
So you and Curtis became friends, and had you wanted to work together for a while or
not necessarily? No, we just kind of hit it off and we were just like bullshitting. And I'd always knew that I wanted to leave Texas. And now that I knew someone in Portland, I kind of latched on a little bit, you know, I'm like, oh man, Portland's an affordable city on the West Coast I can live in. Mm-hmm. Not so much anymore, but yeah, so it was literally like 6 months after I met Curtis. I was like, I think I'm going to move, man. I'm tired of Texas. I'm getting, you know, the politics are awful there always. And I was just tired of the heat. I was tired of working in the sun all the time. I got vitiligo, so my skin's all, it gets, you know, I burn easily if I forget to put on sunscreen. And, you know, it was just like destined almost. I was like, Curtis, yo, if I come, can we get a band together, you know? And he was like, oh, yeah, I got you, dude. Like immediately. So he's usually a guitar player, but he's also an amazing bass player. And, you know, he had his band called Irie Idea, which is just a two piece of him and Morgan. And while, you know, Morgan's on drums, but Curtis will play guitar. He'll play the bass line, the skanks and harmonica and sing all at the same time. And even though they're a two piece, they have enough gear that's actually like a four piece band. And sound guys would still get all pissed off because they got excited that they thought they were running sound for two guys. No. But yeah, because so literally, like, I was like, all right, man, I think I'm going to be there. You know, my wife ended up getting fired from her job. And she was like, oh, she got fired because I mouthed off. So we, you know, I work in the wine industry for a distributor. And I've been doing so for 13 years now. And I ended up quitting. She got me a job at, you know, because blah, blah, blah. I needed a job at the time in 2011. And she was like, oh, you should just come work at the wine warehouse with me. And I was like, all right. Yeah, and let's put all our eggs in one basket. That sounds great. anyway, I ended up quitting because I had something. I had like a bad tiff with one of the guys, and my, you know, in my letter when I quit, I kind of like said, oh, I've lost faith in the management, blah blah blah. You know, and I was kind of went off on a tangent, and then they fired her because of my, you know, letter when I quit. So she was like, I'm not looking for a job in Austin. I was like, yeah, I don't want to live in Austin anymore either. Cause at that point, and no offense, Austin was becoming California, you know, like everybody was like, and I was like, I've always wanted to live in California, but we just couldn't afford it. And so we chose the West Coast. It was either between, the West Coast, like Portland area, or, like, of course I wanted to go to New York or, you know, somewhere up in that area to work with all my friends up there. But ultimately it ended up being Portland because of Curtis. And the very first day we landed, my guitar player Mario from San Antonio helped me drive across the country in a U-Haul with my car on a trailer behind it. And the very first day we got here, we rehearsed with what is now the Dulus, minus Morgan's no longer with us. But yeah, we played a bunch of music that very first day.
So would you say it's a good idea or a bad idea to write an angry letter to your employers when you're quitting?
I don't know, man. I mean, I still work in the industry, so I think it's, I don't know, man. I guess it depends on, man. Yeah, probably it worked out for me. I'll say that.
But you wouldn't just recommend it for anybody.
No. You have to be passionate about something. And I'm passionate about quitting.
Would you say this is a new band? It's pretty much Bandaloos in Portland.
I was just sending a friend a note earlier. I've had over 48 members in this band, like something like that, maybe 50 members. And it's always at the early years, it was always rotating. It wasn't until 2009 I got my San Antonio guys kind of established, where we made, you know, the Daptone record with that band, and also our second record, The Times We Had. Say the question again. I was leading somewhere.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at, would you say it's kind of a different band, you know, from Portland to present?
It isn't anymore, because my Texans moved here. And the only person who's not a Texan in the band is Curtis. And I mean, actually, we do have our homie, our mutual homie, Adam, Mr. Anthony Cotham.
Yes.
He plays keys for us, and Esteban. And it's kind of a rotating, the keyboard situation is kind of a rotating thing. You know, I don't know who's going to be available. And so that's another reason why there's been 48 members or more in the band. I even had to use my dad one time to fill in, and he killed it. I was like, damn, I'm glad my dad could play ska and reggae at the drop of a dime, because that's a hard thing to do, to bubble and pop and all that stuff.
Tell people what Anthony is like. Anthony's a friend of the show. Yes.
Yeah.
Anthony is awesome. He's the Cantagonist. I call him the Cantagonist. He likes to stir the pot. You know what I mean? Like, he's the sweetest. He's the sweetest guy. He's got your back all the time. He's he is all color. I was talking about earlier how Mario's color, Mario and Anthony are the color of the band, and me, Curtis, and now Terrence or Nico, whoever's on drums, are the outlines where we're dancing and we're focused on that. And he is something else, man. He is something else.
I don't know if you know our story with Anthony.
I don't. I kind of do, but I don't.
It's the most random connection, and then it's strange that he is in ska. But I don't know if you know the band Destroy Nate Allen. They used to be based out of Portland. They're like kind of, I don't know, folk punk or whatever, Christian, and they're friends. And we helped them. Adam and I helped record a record with them, just kind of playing the backing instruments and stuff. And they came down here to the Bay Area. We got some musicians and they're like, thank you so much. But we got the keyboardist. We're bringing the keyboardist with us. And that keyboardist was Anthony. And like, wow. Adam and I just remember like thinking, like, God, this guy is just like, you go like, here's the keys. And he goes, he has a full fledged part in like seconds.
Yeah. He was real good.
It's insane. It's insane. I have to rein him in. I'm like, all right, hey, can you not solo over everything? Can you solo only in the solo part? But yeah, I think it's good for him because, I mean, his brain is just is awesome. Like, he's just, that's why we get so like Mr. Bad Luck on the Love a Woman album. It's just like you just go to space and back. It's kind of crazy on that tune and how he, I mean, watching him do that live is it's insane. He's an amazing person.
So Adam, what year did that Destroy Nate album recording happen? Can you remember?
Was that 2013 or 2014?
Okay, so let's say it's in that range. The next time we saw Anthony was at the Mustard Plug.
The show we played together.
A Buck 09 Bandulu show. Yes.
Yeah.
That was what, 2022?
Yeah, that was, man. Yeah, because we had to postpone the first date, right? And then it ended up being in September of that year. Man, that's wild, man. I actually was there whenever he walked up. And he was kind of nervous to talk to you, Adam.
Yeah.
I remember. He was like, I'm going to go talk to my homie. And I was like, I'll walk with you.
And, Anthony probably texts me like once a month. Like, talk about kids and school, all the stuff we're doing.
Mm-hmm. He is one of the best people to keep your friendship going. Like, he is, and no matter how much time will go by, you know, you can always pick back up where you left off. And there's not a lot of people like that. I'm lucky to have quite a few in my lifetime, but that's just how real friends are, right? Like if a year might go by, blah blah blah, you pick up right where you left off. It's always a beautiful thing.
So okay, so. The Love a Woman is your record you recorded in, I don't know when you recorded it, but you released it in 2020.
Yeah. Yeah. We recorded here in Portland. That's the first one with the Portlandulus, as we say. I still had my drummer come up, for a few, my drummer from, San Antonio, Mark, came up for a few things because, Morgan comes from more of a ska punk background and there's just a few feels that he wasn't getting right away. And, we wanted to release this record sooner than later. So he eventually learned from those recordings, I believe. But that was a fun time. That was a good one. I feel like that was the first record that kind of encapsulates what we sound like live. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say that this is the first, and obviously I haven't heard your unreleased record, but this is the first record where I feel like there's character to the sound of the record in a way that's kind of missing from the early stuff.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And to be honest, the first record I thought was just going to be the only one record I ever put out in my entire life. I didn't know what I was doing. I got Vic Ruggiero to play on that one. Wow. Surprisingly. He played a lot of keys on, he did like five or six songs. He played keys on, he sang backup on a couple songs. And that was all again through the Hub City connection at one of those, scooter rallies that I played. I went up there and Vic was there with his lady at the time. And, we ended up bowling around together and kind of shooting the shit. And, we became friends then. And then one day out of the blue sky in 2006, I get a text and he's like, hey man, can you, can you like book me some shows down there? He's like, cause he's coming down. He was coming down to do like, our friend or his friend at the time. Now my friend, Patrick Byrne, they were doing like a documentary thing of, this band called Tremolo Flex. And then it's his band with the guy from New Orleans, Pasquale and someone else, but that part of it ended up not happening. So it just became the Vic show. And then I opened up for him and played with him during that set of that tour.
Yeah. You do a good Vic Ruggiero as well. So
thank you.
So next time you're on the show, we'll work on a script, a conversation between Esteban and Vic, and we'll have you record it.
Oh my gosh. That'd be hilarious. Oh, I look forward to that. That sounds like a lot of fun. Oh man.
So Curtis, I know Curtis, aside from Bandulu's, does record and engineer and stuff. So I'm assuming that's a reason why we're kind of hearing this step up with that record.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So Curtis, recorded, he was the assistant engineer on the 2015 Slackers record, the self-titled record. They did a lot of that record here in Portland at the exact same studio that Love a Woman was recorded at. And the Slackers brought in, Brian from the Agrolites, Brian Dixon. And, so Curtis basically was hit Brian's shadow and ran cables and whatnot. And he still to this day has the notebook where he was just like, it's like his own personal Bible that he goes back to refer to, be like, oh, wait a minute. But I remember on this song, we did this to get this sound, blah, blah, blah. So he's like, oh, let's turn this to that, you know, whatever it might be. But yeah, Curtis, we almost got Curtis to mix the new record, but having the option of it being done in Belgium presented itself. So, so yeah. And it helps, Curtis not have to work so much.
Well, cool. So the record, you know, as of the day we're recording this, the record's already out. And I think you just played your release show a few days ago, right?
Yeah. On Friday.
So how did that go? And how's the reception been for the record so far?
It's been good, man. The place that we play here in town is kind of it's like a speakeasy spot, and they tend to gouge for pricing. So it wasn't as well attended as I like, you know, but that's just me in my own head. We still had a blast. I had my original drum, cause my drummer now, he didn't know he was going to be in the band when I booked this show, and I didn't either. So he's like, bro, I'm going to be in Mexico City, so I can't play that show. I was like, well, that's all right. So I got my original drummer, Patrick Kelly, my mentor. He was Scarnales and the Stingers. That's how I started this. They're the ones, because of Willie Camaro and Patrick Kelly, they're the ones that were like, yo, you need to keep doing this. And they helped me record Sky Reggae Soul. They did all the bass and drums on that. And they're the ones that like really encouraged me to get out there and like, hey, these songs are pretty good. You should keep it going, see where this leads, kind of thing. But yeah, so he came up and played drums, and it's always great when Patrick's in town, because it's just a little piece of home, you know?
The last question here. You guys are going on tour. I think you're going to Europe soon. Do you want to plug that? I think that'd be a good place to end.
Man. So the Batasonic Rocksteady Review Tour with our label mates and friends, the Utopians. I leave on Sunday. You know, we're playing 23 shows in 25 days. Wow. I have to sing 23 days in a row.
You'll be fine.
Yeah. Which is, it's intimidating, man. You know, like, I'm just going to stop talking in between. You know what I mean? Like,
you do warmups?
I do.
Drink lots of water. Do your warmups. Don't stay up till 4 a.m. drinking.
No. I've got to, yeah, I got to have my own little regimen going.
Yeah.
For sure. And I bought a bunch of, what are those, liquid IVs to help with the, you know, to make sure I'm nice and hydrated.
That's good.
But yeah, thanks to Emma, who is also no longer in the band. She's the one that really, she was like, man, we really need to get a kind of like a ritual, pre-show ritual to, you know, our singing abilities, because like, it very, because we play in these clubs that they don't have the best sound, and we're like we're singing. We're not, we're not like a loud, we're loud, but we're not like a loud band with loud guitars and stuff. And so, a lot of times the venues that we play, they don't know how to accommodate for that because of their clientele that they usually, you know, the bands that usually roll through there. And so like, and I hate to say it, man, I was so excited to play at Gilman, and I've never had worse sound. I felt so bad. Like thinking about it afterwards, I was like, oh man. And then I was reluctant to play there the second time. It was a little better, but yeah. So anyway, it's just like that vibe everywhere you go. And when you're trying to sing, we end up trying to compromise or like trying to hear ourselves. And so we're like singing too hard, and then which messes you up for the next day. You know how that is.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with Gilman's sound is they have some good kids that do it, but they don't pay any of them. It's all just like,
yeah.
So like, it's hard to keep anybody decent. And then you've got all these different people rolling through there doing sound. And so like, you know, if they don't take the time to really look at the board,
right,
things can get moved around and they're like, wait, this is supposed to be patched here. And the monitor situation for a while was pretty rough. They were trying to fly the monitors up into the rafters.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I've Link 80 played there once, and I remember the sound person had beef with the band, and we started playing, and they just pushed all the faders up and went home.
Oh man. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh man. So yeah, man, that's the intimidating part, is just like keeping that voice and not having to overcompensate for what you're not hearing.
Sure.
and just try to rely on that muscle memory.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever. Oh yeah, that was a good one. So smooth. You know one of my favorite things about the Bandulu songs, Aaron?
What is it?
I like when Jeremy sings a thing, and then the backup singers like sing the last line back, or like the last word or two. I should start doing that as a co-host.
Yeah, you should do that. And also you should get some backup singers for the next Omnigon record.
Omnigon record.
Maybe some backup screamers.
Screamers. But you know what else you should do? You should listen to the rest of this conversation where, that's right, over on our Patreon. For only $5, folks, you can support this podcast. We can be listener supported and do lots of good stuff, right? Yeah.
This was a very good behind the
curtain. This is actually a great behind the curtain.
We did a bit of dishing. I think that's what we need to be doing more of is some dishing.
Yeah.
If you want to hear the ska tea spilled.
Yeah. If you want to hear us make Jeremy a little uncomfortable, head over behind the curtain.
That all of that, $5 or more, well worth the investment.
Yeah, you can always do $6.90.
Mm-hmm. That's even better.
Nice.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.